This special presentation is sponsored by Audible.com. Go to audiblepodcast.com/shadowcast and get a free audiobook download with your free trial. With over 60,000 titles to choose from, they're sure to have what you're looking for. This is a special offer exclusively offered to my listeners and only available at audiblepodcast.com/shadowcast. This is a Shadowcast Audiobooks feature presentation. Eyes and Knives by Pete Malicki. About the author. Pete Malicki is an Australian author who started writing at the age of 18. Achieving early success, he won a nationwide playwriting competition with his very first play, The New Inhabitant. He went on to complete 5 full-length novels, 20 plays, short stories, poetry, and song lyrics, and he has had articles published online, in magazines, and in newspapers such as the Sydney Morning Herald. In 2009, Pete founded his own independent publishing company, Helm Publishing, and printed this, his 4th novel, Eyes and Knives. And without further ado, I give you Eyes and Knives, Episode 2. Wednesday, early afternoon. Rod Fitzgerald stood panting in the lobby as he waited for the elevator to return to the ground floor. Running the 100 meters from where he'd parked, what was left of his car had tired him out a lot more than it should have. He was out of shape. Glancing irritably at his watch, he started pacing around and straightening his clothes. When the elevator arrived, it was packed full of anxious-looking business folk. They piled into the lobby and dispersed out onto the street. Rod entered the cramped metal box and hit the button for level 24. Nothing happened. The lift was disabled because of a fire in the lunchroom on level 15. During such an emergency, one could only catch a lift towards the ground. If you wanted to go up, you had to hope there was someone on a higher floor calling the lift. This made it kind of difficult for the fire brigade to get to the actual source of the fire. It wasn't a very intelligent system for the world's largest technology company. But then again, who would ever suspect they were the world's largest technology company with such a silly system? It was a good cover. By the time Rod had given up hope of the elevator ever arriving and walked up over 20 flights of stairs, he was significantly late for his presentation. Fortunately for him, the meeting had been postponed by a half hour due to a minor security breach. "What happened to you, Fincher?" asked the man Rod sat next to. His name was Corey Fox, head of operations, a short, skinny man. Corey's job was to ensure that all of Star Market Systems' projects ran smoothly and finished on time. He was also the private doctor of the business and provided a wide range of hard-to-get medication for the staff. "Had a bit of a prang, Fox. The car's looking a lot worse than I do." "Tough luck. I take it that's why you're late." "Yep. Why haven't we started yet?" "Seems like a fire broke out in the call center, level 15. Mr. Security's just checking the videos." Speaking of the devil, a brawny young man named Dane Hobson walked through the door and sat down at the table. At only 28, he was the youngest member of Star Market Systems' senior management team. The cold, unfaltering, serious expression on his face earned him the respect that his years couldn't manage on their own. Nobody questioned his status as chief of security. Dane handed a DVD to the chief executive officer and nodded curtly. "This is footage of the incident and the file of Rory Henderson, the perpetrator." The CEO took the DVD and put it in his jacket pocket. "Thank you, Dane," he said with an appreciative smile. "The fire has been extinguished and we will investigate it thoroughly. My personal suspicion is that it is just the work of a disgruntled staff member, nothing sinister. I would doubt he has any idea about Star Market Systems' true nature. But let's not allow this distraction to take up any more of our time. We have business to get on with. Firstly, I'd like to talk about Paul Hirsch. All of us here, bar Rod, were present at the meeting yesterday. Is that correct?" The dozen or so people sitting at the table nodded their assent. "Mr. Fincher, are you aware of what happened yesterday?" Rod shook his head. "Not in detail. All I heard was what was on the news. I spoke to Dane this morning, who confirmed who it was." "Okay," said the CEO. "Paul Hirsch, as you all know, was the most senior manager among the telemarketers. He's been working with us nigh on a dozen years, which also makes him the longest-standing employee who was not aware of the technology side of our company. Paul was a tribute to our ability to keep secrets." He turned to face Rod. "During our board meeting yesterday, he stood up at an entirely random interval, behaved erratically, then charged the window. It took him a few hits, but he managed to break the glass and jump to his death. After the initial shock period, I asked everyone if they knew why he would commit suicide, or if they had anything to do with it. All present claimed ignorance. Now, Rod, I'm asking you, as our head scientist, have you any idea why Paul Hirsch did such a thing? Were you conducting some kind of experiment? Testing a new drug? Rod Fincher, known to the outside world as Rod Fitzgerald, made a surprised noise. He was surprised because the CEO so flippantly asked him if he had committed a murder, albeit in the name of one of his many experiments. Usually these were not discussed, even amongst the most trusted in the senior management team. No, sir, this was not my doing. Any experiment in which I could make a man kill himself would be one I'd tell you about well in advance. If it had been me, you'd have known about it. And besides, I wouldn't use our own people as fodder. The CEO nodded, his face void of any judgments. One of his leading qualities was his ability to mask his suspicions, always having an air of impartiality. It was hard to keep any information away from the man, and harder still to know what he did and didn't know. Good. Supposing that no one is being dishonest, we can rule out an inside job. However, that brings us no closer to understanding why a well-paid marketing executive would kill himself in such an unusual manner. All of us saw him go crazy before he smashed his way out the window. I would like to know why. Maybe he'd develop morals, suggested the head of communications. All present, with the exception of Dane Hobson, chuckled at that one. Paul may have been so upset with his life that he decided to kill himself, but I don't think it was quite that bad, said Jenna Albright with a lazy half-smile. Half of the senior managers glanced over at her breasts. Okay, enough jokes, said the CEO in a voice pleasant yet authoritative. I'd like you all to listen out for any hints of a motive for his suicide. Mr. Hobson, I trust you'll make this a priority. The chief of security nodded wordlessly, his expression remaining unchanged. Thank you. Until we have more information, there's nothing else to say on the matter. I would like to move on to a presentation from our top research and development scientists. Mr. Rodney Fincher, the project his team's been working on is now ready to be launched through Star Market Australia, so I believe it is a good time as ever to show you all what it's about. Quite a different product from what we usually develop, but I shall say no more. Rod, would you care to take the stage? Suppressing the emotions caused by his car accident, Rod thanked the CEO, made his way to the head of the table, and plugged his laptop into a projector. His presentation appeared against a white screen, and he referred to it as he spoke. Good day, everyone. I know that much of what the scientists do at Star Market Systems is considered to be a mystery by the bulk of you here. We are forever working on projects you know little or nothing about. This is partly due to the fact that our work is top secret, even for a top secret organization. It is also due to the fact that we are the world's top scientists in a range of fields, so we're pretty damned hard to understand. Everyone but Dane chuckled. But before I introduce you to our latest creation, I'd like to talk briefly about some of the projects we've implemented during the past 12 months and discuss their progress. In all seriousness, it seems strange to me that some of you don't really know what goes on in the R&D department. Aside from its front of being involved in the telemarketing industry, this company revolves 100% around its technological discoveries and advances. Without the scientists, and I don't mean to undermine anybody's job here, you would have nothing but a call center full of fuckwits. Dane snorted. Thank you, Dane. My point is, we aren't selling toilet paper or coffee or George Foreman grills or whatever it is those guys sell. We're selling weapons, drugs, and new technologies to foreign governments and powerful organizations. Some of what we make can be used for good, but the majority of it is potentially immoral. If what we do was ever exposed, each and every one of us would be considered criminals of the worst caliber. As it stands, none of us have the criminal records we deserve. I was caught shoplifting when I was 14, piped Corey Fox, head of operations. All but one of the assembled people laughed. Well, I think you all see what I'm saying, Rod continued smoothly. You live your lives as criminals for the sake of what we, the scientists, produce. Hell, we even have fake identities to protect our business, not to mention the initiation ritual. Why go to this extreme if you don't even know what it is your company is doing? Is it really just for the car and the millions? What's the initiation ritual? All eyes turned to Jenna Albright. Mouths hung open. Dane looked exceptionally uncomfortable as the CEO turned to face him. Mr. Hobson, I thought only the men in our board had to do that, sir. There was a very long, uncomfortable pause. I did it. All eyes turned to Miss Ella. Miss Ella was a tall, scrawny woman who was heavily involved in surveillance and monitoring. It was her job to record people's movements. She watched people within Star Market systems and people on the outside who interested them. Not that anyone would know the figures. Miss Ella had broken into approximately 712 houses to plant bugs and tracking devices. When she left work at the end of the day, not even Dane, as the chief of security, knew where she went. She was feared more than anyone else at Star Market Systems Australia, bar the CEO, because she was the most enigmatic. Her appearance only added to her intrigue. No one that weak-looking should be responsible for doing what she did. Dane started to speak.
Yes, but we needed to make sure we could trust you.
And you don't need to trust Jenna? What about Karen? She must have done it, too.
There was another uncomfortable silence. The CEO broke it.
A quick word after the meeting, Mr. Hobson.
It was not a request.
Sir.
Dane acquiesced. Taking the initiative after another short silence, Rod Fincher continued with his presentation.
I believe you each have a duty to keep yourself informed as to what projects the R&D Department of Star Market Systems has undertaken. I appreciate that a lot of what we do is kept quiet, but today we are making some of our recent projects public for those in management. This presentation I've been working on will be given to all of you after the meeting. I recommend taking a thorough look through it. For now, I shall summarize these works and introduce our new project, due to be launched very shortly.
Rod spent the next 6 or 7 minutes telling the assembled managers about some of the inventions the scientists had designed and tested. Expressions ranged from avid interest, boredom, amusement, and disgust as he described the outcomes of their experiments. First had been an array of tools and weaponry, such as a functional pen that doubled as a Class 4 laser. It was powerful enough to burn through steel, though it couldn't cut very deep. They'd gone through 8 test subjects in the process of designing this weaponry. Test subjects meaning people, and gone through meaning killed. After the weapons came an ingenious tracking and listening device that was shaped like a cockroach. It could function automatically, scuttling under a fridge or furniture if it detected movement, or by remote control. Its design was so realistic that if someone stepped on it, synthetic guts would spill out. They would never suspect it was anything but a real cockroach. The crowd favorite was a device identical to a dollar coin. When pressed in the specific way, it transmitted a short-range electrical impulse that triggered a strong sexual response from anyone it was directed at. To demonstrate this, Rod had given the sales manager, Alex Bell, an erection. After running through the other projects that the research and development team had been working on, Rod Fitzgerald Fincher was ready to introduce their latest creation. Given that it was his own design, he was particularly proud of it. "So what is it that all children love?" he asked. "When you guys were little kids, what did you want your parents to get you for Christmas or for your birthdays?" No one responded, but Rod was sure they were thinking of puppies. "Let me tell you, I wanted a puppy, or a kitten. I think you'll find it's a common desire for a 6-year-old. What's my point? Well, puppies turn into dogs, and dogs aren't as cute as puppies. I got Spot on my 9th birthday, and I loved her intensely for 6 months. After that, she only ever annoyed me with her barking and neediness. People love puppies, but they don't like dogs. Myself and the rest of the R&D team at Star Market Systems have come up with a solution to this problem." There was an air of curious anticipation. Our genetically modified perma-puppy. Nobody made a sound. Wednesday, late evening.
"Aren't you going to get me to the hospital? I'm in pain here. Come on, this isn't right. Look at me. My leg is swollen to the size of a... I don't know. It's bloody huge, and I've lost a liter of blood. Look at my singlet. It's purple, for Christ's sake. It was blue before I passed out. How was I supposed to have committed arson in this state, let alone murder anyone? I can't even remember a goddamn thing. I passed out on my way to the train station. That's it. Maybe I'm the victim of a beating or something, and you've mistaken me for the culprit. That would explain my memory loss."
Probationary Constable Rick Blackman sighed heavily, folded his newspaper, and placed it on the desk he was sitting at. He walked over to the cell door, where Rory Henderson was trying to squeeze his face through the peephole. The burly policeman pulled the shutter across and returned to sit with his offsider.
"You know the thing that always gets me about murderers," he said.
The other officer, Constable Allison Jacobs, smiled with polite interest.
"What's that, Rick?"
"Instead of just pretending they don't know anything about the murder in question, they invariably blame it on someone else. There's always some convoluted story about what they were doing at the time. If you were truly innocent, you wouldn't have any reason to know anything about some guy who was killed in Queensland 3 years ago. Their excuses are so well thought out, they've obviously been concocted for some reason."
Allison thought this was rubbish, considering the phrase most uttered by criminals in relation to the crime they committed is, "I don't know what you're talking about."
"Yes, that's an interesting point, that is."
"If this little dickin' here had half a brain, he'd be claiming he knew nothing about the murder. I mean, who's going to believe that he's the victim? Does he think he's going to fool anyone?
I don't know, Rick.
I'll bet you he pleads not guilty. Don't mind the dozens of witnesses who'll most likely testify against you, Rory. You didn't do anything. God, he'd have to be so stupid to deny his guilt. It will cost him a reduced sentence.
That wouldn't be too bright, Rick.
Rory slumped against the wall as the police officers discussed his lack of intellect. They didn't even have the decency to speak quietly so that he couldn't hear them. No one had explained to him exactly what he had done yet, but from the conversations he'd overheard, it sounded like he was in a lot of trouble. Murder? Arson? Assault? Theft? How can you do all that when you're unconscious? You can't. It's impossible. That could only mean he was innocent, or sleepwalking. The police officers abruptly stopped talking. There was a moment of silence, then a creaky door swung open and someone entered the room. Rory strained to hear what this softly spoken newcomer said.
Allison, Rick, I have some worrying news. After we arrested the young man you have in custody, Brad Grass drove away from the scene, alone. He left his partner behind, which is unlike him. There were no other jobs to go to, and he never returned to the station. This was strange enough, but we've just received a call from a concerned resident in our patrol who saw a police car drive into our neighbor's house. Brad's nowhere to be seen.
Is he answering the phone?
Asked probationary Constable Blackman.
Rick, if he answered his phone, do you think I'd be here telling you this? Use your brain.
Sorry, sir.
Allison spoke up.
What shall we do, sir? Find him. Here's the address of the woman whose house he parked in.
Both of us? Asked Rick.
Both of you.
What about the prisoner?
What about him, Rick? He's locked in a cell. Just hurry up and find Brad, will you?
Rory listened as the police officers collected their things and walked away, leaving him alone in the brightly lit cell. His torn and bloody singlet was little protection against the cold. He'd lost his thongs at some point, and the police had confiscated his wallet. Full of despair, he lay down on the uncomfortably hard pallet and wrapped himself in a thin sheet. He had nothing left but a train ticket. Wednesday, night. Marnie heard a scratching sound coming from her open window. She looked over towards it, but the patient in the other bed was blocking her view. She wanted to get up and see what was making the noise, but getting up when you're in a hospital bed isn't always easy. A rubber bag hung from a stand and fed her saline solution through a cannula in her wrist. If she wanted to go anywhere, she'd have to wheel the stand with her and risk an accident. The room was plunged into momentary darkness as something blocked out the moonlight. Then there was a small thump as the same something landed on the carpet. It sounded like a person had just come in through the window. Whoever they were and whatever they wanted, they would find Marnie sleeping. She was asleep, deeply asleep.
Marnie?
Marnie yelped and scrambled towards the back of her bed, pulling her blankets up around herself protectively. The patient next to her stirred and grumbled.
It's okay, Marnie. I'm a friend.
Who are you?
The tall man came closer, cautiously, as though approaching a cornered animal.
My name is Ian. I heard what happened to you, and I want to help.
Marnie narrowed her eyes.
How did you hear about me? Everyone here thinks I'm crazy.
I don't think you're crazy, Ian responded as he sat down on a chair near Marnie's bed. She edged away from him, knuckles white from gripping her blanket so tightly. No woman would abandon her baby like you did without a damn good reason. I'm guessing you can't remember what you were doing during the night.
But who are you, Ian? How do you know what happened to me, and why the fuck didn't you just come in through the door?
Ian smiled.
Visiting hours are over, Marnie. I'm with the police, and we are very concerned about what happened to you. Show me your badge.
Excuse me?
You're with the police? Show me your badge.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Ian reached into his pants and produced a wallet. He flipped it open and handed it to the distraught woman, who looked at it and peered suspiciously at the badge.
Okay, she said. So you're a cop. That doesn't explain why you came in through the window.
For your own safety, we don't want anyone to know you're speaking to the police.
Fine, whatever. What do you want?
I would like you to tell me exactly what happened to you. What can you remember of the past couple of days? Marnie released her grip on the blankets and lay back, staring at the ceiling. She spoke with a nasal dialect, a sign to Ian that she came from rural Queensland.
I was out shopping in the city with my baby, and I was walking along the footpath, minding my own business like I always do. Nothing out of the ordinary, nothing until I looked up and saw someone falling out of the sky. Then I felt a wave of nausea, like the worst kind of morning sickness.
She trailed off.
What did you do next? Ian asked gently. I don't know. I can't remember anything. All of a sudden I was somewhere miles away outside an electronics store with TVs on display in the windows. It was morning.
My leg is in a hell of a lot of pain. My clothes were all torn up and covered with blood. I have no idea what happened to me. I could have been dead for all I can remember of last night. The tall man was quiet. The man in the other bed wasn't.
Can you keep your voices down? He said. I'm trying to sleep here.
Marty jolted in shock. She tensed up again, and Ian placed a calming hand on her shoulder. I'm sorry, my friend, he said to the patient. We will be quieter.
What are you doing here anyway? Visitors aren't allowed this late.
Much to Ian's surprise, Marty said, He's my husband. We haven't had a chance to talk since I was brought here. The man in the other bed rolled away from them, snorting disdainfully. Tell me, Marty, what did you do after you woke up? Marty turned her gaze back to the ceiling. I screamed. I was scared and hurting all over, and I had no idea where my child was. Someone called the police, who called me an ambulance as soon as they arrived. They talked to me for a bit, but I'd done nothing wrong, so they left as soon as the ambulance came. I've been here all day now, telling skeptical fucking nurses that have no idea what happened to me. They keep trying to find out who hurt me, like this was domestic violence. I just want to see my baby. Ian, who had been nodding, placed a finger against his lips and spun to face the door. Marty regarded him with wide-eyed puzzlement. For a long moment, everything was still. Then all of a sudden, the door burst open and a tall figure came rushing into the room. This person was dressed in black clothes and a balaclava. Ian jumped to his feet and positioned himself between the intruder and Marnie, who screamed.
Who are you?
The newcomer hissed at Ian. It was a woman.
Who are you? Ian retorted. I'm seeing my wife. You lie. She's not married.
Before Ian could argue it out, the woman leapt forwards and grabbed his shoulders. Her foot hooked around and caught the back of his knee, sending him to the ground. Ian was no weakling, however, and he managed to grab the woman's arm and bring her down on top of himself. Marnie screamed again as the pair crashed into the side of her bed.
"'What's going on?'
asked the other patient as he leapt off the bed. Debilitating pain from an injured hamstring caused him to crumple to the ground, moaning. The woman in black pressed her knee into Ian's gut as she tried to pin his arms down. He thrashed around on the floor as he tried to escape her grip, grunting with the effort. He managed to free an arm, and he grabbed one of the woman's breasts. Ian fought dirty. The lights came on just as the intruder roared with pain and indignation. The nurse was standing in the doorway.
"'What's going on?' she asked. "'Who are you?'
Without a second's pause, the woman sprang to her feet and charged the nurse. There was a loud thud as she hammered against the wall. As quickly as she had arrived, the intruder vanished around the corner. Ian wasted no time making his own escape. He told Marnie she'd be okay, stepped over the patient who was writhing on the floor, and exited via the window. It was only the second story, so he jumped straight down into some bushes. The lanky man then scrambled to his feet and ran towards the tree which his bike was leaning against. He'd be long gone before the nurse phoned the police. As Ian cycled past the hospital's emergency entrance, two paramedics climbed into their ambulance. A police officer had just called and told them a woman with severe abdominal wounds needed urgent medical help.
Wednesday, mid-afternoon. Sir? The CEO looked up as his chief of security entered the room. He had been perusing Rod Fincher's presentation. Mr. Hobson, take a seat. Dane sat. What do you think of science's latest masterpiece? With full respect to what they've done in the past, sir, I think this whole thing is an embarrassment. Why is that, Dane? And before you answer, remember that I value your opinion. I have also always admired your forthrightness. Thank you, sir. Well, like Fincher said, we are all putting a lot on the line so that research and development can research and develop. I needn't tell you that I enjoy my work, but I don't much like killing and tormenting people in the name of fluffy animals. I always thought Star Market was here to develop powerful technologies and the likes for the purpose of gathering intelligence, not fulfilling the dreams of five-year-olds. The CEO nodded expressionlessly, then sat staring for a long moment. His eyes did not move from Dane's face until he finally spoke. I see your point, Dane, but you're being short-sighted. The issue of genetic modification has always been a controversial one, and has had negative impacts on Star Market systems worldwide. If we can bring acceptance to this kind of technology, our other business fronts will benefit greatly. Think of how much profit Monsanto is losing because of fucks like Greenpeace. How's your man doing there, by the way? At Greenpeace? Good. He's working his way through the place, made his way into HR and some files. We've got details on all their staff. Good. Anyway, we will be operating this project under the name Permapets. Hopefully we can bring a family image and positive connotations to genetic modification. These pets will not sell cheaply either. We won't have to subsidize them with our other businesses too much. The CEO took a sip of coffee from a Star Market Systems mug. Of equal importance, Dane, we are trialing the science of indefinite lifespans. Better to waste the lives of puppies and kitties before we move our experiments onto humans. Dane smiled wryly. And how many puppies have we gone through so far? Hundreds, maybe even thousands. Half a dozen each day since the cook changed the cafeteria's lunch menu. Dane stared at the CEO, waiting for a smile. It never came. Anyway, you will read this report tonight and hopefully gain some new insights, the CEO said dismissively. But as you know, this was not why you were summoned. Why has Jenna not completed the initiation ritual? Color filled Dane's usually stoic face. I didn't think she was supposed to, sir. I didn't think someone in her position would really need to go... Is it not Star Market System's policy that all of our technical people undergo the ritual?
Yes.
Then you had better offer me an explanation. Not an excuse, an explanation. Dane shifted uneasily. I suppose that I thought she looked like she shouldn't be put through such a test. She seems to, I don't know, innocent? The CEO slammed his fist against the meeting table. You fool! This puts a big mark on your otherwise perfect record. Hobson, considering what Jenna Albright does here, would you expect such a deception from her? She's only doing administrative work for human resources. It's not like she's on security detail or dealing with research. No, Dane, it's not a trivial thing. She is the linchpin behind some of the businesses we control. She trains our upcoming managers on how to deal with the media, the general public, and their own staff. When we put people in bear, she was responsible for teaching them how to keep their managers in the dark about what they really do. Hardly anyone in bear even knows who they're really working for, and it's largely because of her efforts. Paul Hirsch was oblivious to what Star Market Systems did for all those years, and again, it's largely thanks to Jenna Albright.
I feel stupid, sir. I underestimated her.
And I am not impressed. I can't believe you've neglected one of your most important duties. Have her bring a head to me by midday tomorrow. Sir. Good. And Dane, before you do anything else, I want you to deliver a message to Miss Ella. Tell her I want to meet the woman who abandoned her pram outside our building when Paul Hirsch jumped. Pass on these details to her. The chief of security at Star Market Systems reached forward and took an envelope from his superior. With the faintest hint of a smile, he nodded at the CEO and left. Thursday, midnight. Probationary Constable Rick Blackman was not happy. After being part of the team who'd captured that scoundrel Rory Henderson, he would have appreciated being let off at the end of his shift. Instead, he'd been forced into overtime to chase after a colleague who'd somehow managed to drive his squad car into a civilian's house.
I really hate it when I have to do a job at the end of the shift. 5 minutes before home time and boss comes up and gives you some shit job and you just have to say yes. I don't even like Brad Bloody Grass, and now I have to cover for his stupid arse because he's driven into somebody's living room.
Yes, it's a bit unfair, replied Constable Allison Jacob, who'd secretly had a crush on Brad Grass and thought Rick was being an asshole.
How do you reckon he did it, anyway? It takes a big bloody effort to crash into a house. They're mostly nowhere near the damned road.
I don't know, Rick.
Take a left, Allison. Well, at least we'll get some nice photos for the Christmas party. It'll be a nice change from those pics of you and your girlfriend.
Allison blushed. 5 years ago, at the age of 21, she had been going through an experimental phase. Her then-boyfriend had taken photos of her and her then-best friend Christina as they wrestled in the bathtub wearing nothing but baby oil. 2 years ago, these photos came through registered mail to the Helm Police Station, where they went straight to the photocopier.
It's just around the corner here, Allison. I think we better pull over and walk so the car doesn't scare anyone off.
Allison pulled over, wondering why she always took orders when she was the senior officer. They left the car and walked around the corner to the scene of the accident. Sure enough, there was Officer Grass's car, its rear end sticking out of the hole it had made in the expensive brick house. The front door was wide open, and light was spilling out into the garden. The letterbox was hanging from a tree. Strangely, there was no one around. It may have been midnight, but a spectacle like this would normally have the neighbors milling about in their pajamas. Where were they?
Old Brad's car made quite an effort, laughed Rick as he started down the short driveway. This is going to be one hell of a Christmas party.
Allison shook her head in disgust as she trailed after her partner. The ignorant bastard would make a joke out of anything. If a child got hit by a bus in front of them, he'd probably laugh and yell out, "Busted!" When they reached the front door, the mood quickly changed. There on the floor was a middle-aged woman, lying in an expanded puddle of blood and feebly pawing at her belly. She must have been stabbed or even shot in the abdomen. Rick stood stunned as Allison rushed over to perform first aid.
"You're going to be okay, sweetie. We're here to help you. Tell me what happened. Where's the bleeding coming from?"
The woman groaned as she attempted to wriggle away.
"No, don't try to move. Just lie still and talk to me."
Allison looked pointedly at her partner. "Officer Blackman has called an ambulance, and they'll be here any minute." Taking the cue, Rick pulled out his phone and called for an ambulance.
"Who did this to you, sweetie? What exactly is causing the bleeding?"
The woman closed her eyes, her brow furrowed in pain.
"Shot," she managed. "Policeman."
"Okay then, sweetie. I'm just going to grab something to stop this bleeding. I'll be back with you in 5 seconds. Allison got to her feet and ran to the kitchen to find some cling wrap, an effective bandage for abdominal wounds. By the time she returned, however, the woman was dead.
"We lost her," said Allison. "We've damn well lost her."
Probationary Constable Rick Blackman took a moment to consider the words that came instantly to mind. Deciding they wouldn't be wise, he said them anyway. He pointed.
"She's right there, Allison."
Allison Jacobs stood up and stormed over to her colleague. Just as she was about to slap the stupid grin right off his face, a loud thud from another room made them both turn their heads. They drew their firearms in unison and moved toward the source of the sound. There was a trail of blood on the carpet, which they followed through the house. It ended at a sturdy oak door that had been locked from the outside. Whoever was on the other side of this door was trying their very best to knock it down.
"This is the police," said Rick as he tried to regain the initiative. "So is this," came a reply. "I want to get out."
"Brad, is that you?"
called Allison as she moved over to the door.
"Are you okay?"
"Open the door." "Don't open the door," Rick countered. "He's a murder suspect."
Allison turned around.
"He's our colleague. Someone has locked him in that room."
"He might be locked in that room for a very good reason. That woman said she was shot by a policeman."
"God, you can be such a..." "Oh, hi there."
Rick wheeled around to see who his partner had addressed so politely in such a tense situation. It was a pair of ambulance officers, one male, one female.
"Oh, hi guys. I take it you saw the woman out in the living room."
The male paramedic spoke.
"Yes, we did. What's going on here? Are we safe to attend to the body?"
"We noticed one of your cars around the corner and we assumed it was safe to enter,"
the female paramedic added.
"Though one of you picked a strange place to park."
"That was a stupid assumption for you to make,"
started Rick, but Allison cut him off. "That was our colleague, Officer Grass," she said. "He's been locked in this room and we were just letting him out." She pulled the door open and was instantly knocked aside by the disheveled Brad. His uniform was crumpled and torn down one side, his hair was a mess, and his knuckles were caked in blood. It looked like he'd been trying to punch his way out of the room. Before anyone had a chance to ask him any questions, he lurched towards the gun at Allison's waist. Rick fired a shot into Brad's forearm, sending him sprawling onto the carpet. Without even the smallest cry of pain, he jumped back to his feet and rounded on his assailant.
"Stay right where you are, or I'll put one in your leg," said Rick.
"No, Rick, stop," screamed Allison.
The bedraggled policeman looked down at his arm, which was dripping blood all over his clothes and onto the carpet. Without a word, he pushed his way past Allison and charged toward the exit. Before he'd taken 3 steps, Rick had him on the floor.
"Don't move, Grass. You're under arrest."
Rick Blackman cuffed his colleague's wrists together behind his back, grinning cruelly as he grabbed the forearm he'd just put a bullet in.
"This wound isn't life-threatening. The ambos can come back when they're done with your victim."
Then, for no discernible reason, the male paramedic turned and started running away.
"Where are you going?"
his female counterpart called.
"Hey!"
"Hey!" said Rick. "Where's he going?"
What happened? What's going on?"
spluttered Brad. He seemed disoriented.
"Brad, are you okay?"
asked Allison as she bent down. Rick scowled at her and tightened the handcuffs around Brad's wrists.
"Where's your friend going?" Rick asked again. "He has work to do."
"I have no idea." "Where am I?" said Brad.
He seemed like a different person to the one who'd been bashing at the door.
"How did I get here?"
Amidst the excitement and confusion, Allison had a chilling revelation. Brad's strange behavior put her in the mind of the way Rory Henderson had reacted when they'd arrested him earlier in the day. Both had been acting erratically, then, all of a sudden, claimed to have no idea what was going on. As though they were possessed. That wasn't all. When Rory had collapsed on the ground, Brad Grass had inexplicably run to his car and driven off. Now that Brad was coming back to his senses, the ambulance officer had run away. There was no rational explanation for this behavior, but it must be more than mere coincidence. As she watched the female paramedic strap Brad's forearm, Allison knew that something wasn't right. Something bad was going on here. In that very moment, Allison Jacobs knew a lot of people were going to die. Purchase an author-signed copy of Eyes and Knives with a 50% discount on postage. Email helmpublishing@gmail.com with Shadowcast in the subject heading. You will receive an invoice through PayPal, and your signed copy will be posted to you upon receipt of payment. The music featured in this episode was The Cove by The Contrarian. Thanks for listening.